Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details you'll find at our anchor page, which is offbeatoregon.com. Check it out. But first, sit back and relax and let me tell you the story of the dumbest would-be pirates in the history of the universe. Today we're going to meet a couple of liquored-up Navy deserters who plan to A. seize control of a passenger liner, B. drive it on to the beach in the middle of the night, and C. steal away into the night with 3 tons of gold. It's probably safe to say that they didn't think their plans through very well. This story was first published on April 17th, 2010, under the headline, Amateur Pirates' Bumbling Scheme Didn't Work Out As They'd Planned. All right, here we go. It was probably the last act of piracy ever carried out on a commercial ship within American territorial waters. And it was a pathetic one. In fact, piracy may be the wrong word. It had a lot more in common with a couple of clumsy freelancers trying to hijack a 727 than anything Blackbeard would have done. Still, piracy it was, if Webster's New World Dictionary is to be believed. And what its perpetrators lacked in brains, they certainly made up for in ambition. Their plan was for the two of them to take over a 253-foot passenger steamer, run it aground, and slip off into the woods with the $2 million worth of gold that they believed he was carrying. This was a bad plan on so many levels, for so many reasons, that it's hard to know just where to start. Perhaps it's best to simply tell the story. In the summer of 1910, 30-year-old U.S. Navy sailor French West had come up with a plan. All he needed was a real good friend. It seemed he'd found that friend in a 26-year-old shipmate named George Washington Wise, a sailor from Boston. The idea was the two of them would slip away from their ship, which was stationed at San Francisco Bay, and travel to Seattle. There, they'd take passage on one of the big steamers that hauled gold out of Alaska and down to San Francisco via Seattle. Then, off the coast of Oregon, in the middle of the night, they'd storm into the wheelhouse and take over. They'd put the helm over, beach the ship, hop overboard, and disappear into the woods with the loot. How could they possibly have thought this would work? Even making allowances for the benefit of hindsight, it's hard to imagine how West and Wise could possibly have thought it would. The ship they had in mind was a huge, ocean-going passenger liner full of people who lived in Seattle. In 1910, Seattle was a frontier city awash with miners back from the gold fields of the Yukon and Alaska. Many of these guys carried .32 revolvers around in their pockets like we carry cell phones today. You know how miners are, and you know how claim jumpers are. Those passengers couldn't really be counted on to just sit quietly by if they were to find out that their ship was being jacked, particularly if some of the gold that was being transported on that passenger liner was theirs. Which, by the way, I have not been able to find out whether that was the case or not. But even if West and Wise could avoid waking up the passengers, this idea of running a steamer head-on into the side of a randomly selected piece of Oregon coast scenery in the middle of the night, it's a little like flipping a coin. Heads, you hit a beach and live, maybe. Tails, you hit rocks and die, for sure. And if they won that coin toss, there they would be on a strange beach in the middle of the night, trying to slip away from a couple hundred angry passengers, plus whatever locals might be on hand, with $2 million worth of gold. $2 million worth. Okay, let's break that down. In 1910, gold was $21 an ounce. So, $2 million worth was just a little shy of 6,000 pounds. 3 tons of gold. A ton and a half for each of them. They'd need, like, 3 F-150s, or actually no, they would need 5 F-150s to haul that away. Well, most likely, West and Wise thought, as many did at the time, that the Oregon coast was a howling and uninhabited wilderness, a great place for capital criminals to go for quiet time while on the lam. They would no doubt have been astonished at the number of well-armed local residents ready to welcome them, pretty much wherever they landed. And finally, Well, it's a minor point, but if you go to my website and take a look, there's a photo of the Buckman in dry dock. It's like the third picture down on the webpage. And if you do that, take a look at it, notice the color change on the hull, which shows the waterline, and then notice the size of the workman in relation to the amount of hull below that waterline. As you will immediately see, even beached, the Buckman would be in water far too deep for the men to wade ashore, and they'd also be beyond the line of breakers. This thing drew about 16, 18 feet. So how were they going to get off the ship? Swim through the surf? In a lifeboat, which is, by the way, definitely not designed to handle surf conditions. Ingot by ingot, maybe? In a lifeboat? Through the breakers? It's probably safe to suggest that West and Wise did not think the plan over very carefully. They did prepare for it in another way, though. With lots and lots of drinks. And in the wee small hours of the morning of August 21st, 1910, there the two of them were, thoroughly braced with spirits and padding along the deck to the wheelhouse of the 253-foot, 2,000-ton passenger steamer S.S. Buckman, ready to give it a good go. The ship was about 20 miles off the mouth of the Umpqua River at the time. Just exactly what happened next is difficult to know, because every account of the attack is a little bit different. But after reading them all, giving extra credence to eyewitness accounts in contemporary newspapers, I'd say this is probably pretty close to what actually happened. West and Wise opened the wheelhouse door. Second Mate Fred Plath and Quartermaster Otto Kohlmeister looked up in alarm, and then the guns came out. A revolver in Wise's fist and a sawed-off double-barrel shotgun in West's hands. Plath was ordered to stretch out on the deck, and Kohlmeister, the pilot, remained, hands on the wheel. According to Stan Allen, he was, quote, cursing vigorously. I like that image. But already there was a problem. The captain wasn't there. Leaving Wise to cover them in the wheelhouse, West raced aft to the captain's cabin. A couple of my sources suggest that before he did this, he had Kohlmeister put the helm over and point the ship towards land. If that was the case, that was his big mistake of the evening. Because Captain Edwin B. West already knew something was going on well before Mr. West arrived at his cabin. And the sources are suggesting that he was awakened by the heavy rolling of the ship, which would have told him that the helm had been put over and the vessel had changed direction and was now heading straight towards land. Given what usually happens when a steamship gets too close to the Oregon coast, it makes perfect sense that this would ring massive alarm bells in the skipper's head. He was probably getting ready to run to the wheelhouse and ask what the hell was going on when West got there and found him reaching for a pistol. The pirate let him have it with both barrels. The captain died in his tracks. Up in the wheelhouse, this burst of gunfire startled Wise, who poked his head out to see what had happened, and one of his prisoners, most sources say it was Kohlmeister, took advantage of this opportunity to reach up above the wheel and yank the whistle cord. The liner's steam-powered whistle screamed a three-digit decibel alarm. Now suddenly the whole ship was awake and wondering what was going on. West, hustling back from the captain's cabin, arrived just in time to start collecting crew members. Like lobsters entering a trap, they would run into the wheelhouse to see what was going on and see West there with his guns on them. He had a revolver in addition to his now empty shotgun. West would then order each newcomer to join the growing line of men standing by the bridge ropes. West was sent by Wise to smash the radio telegraph, knowing the onboard Sparky was probably already warming the apparatus up. You have to remember, this is 1910, so radio is brand new. This probably had just occurred to Wise that there probably was an onboard radio on this ship, and that the last thing he probably wanted was Sparky sending SOS messages all over the place. Actually, at the time, it would have been CQD because the SOS code had not yet been thought up. In any case, Mr. Wise, now remember, Mr. Wise was the sidekick and Mr. West was the major bad guy. Well, Wise lost his nerve. Perhaps the liquor was wearing off. So instead of going to the radio room, West went to his cabin and crawled into his bunk and started crying. This was pretty much the end of West's hopes for a profitable end to this venture. He had about 8 crew members lined up in the wheelhouse facing his double-barreled shotgun and revolver, and more crew members were coming up. Then one approached from the other side of the bridge just as West was kneeling down to reload his shotgun. He turns to cover the newcomer with his gun, and here's what happens, quote, Seeing that our chance for escape was ripe, I yelled to the crew to run, Chief Mate Richard Brennan told the San Francisco Examiner afterwards. We all broke in different directions. For my part, I ran and jumped through the galley skylight, landing on the cook's hot stove. Soon West was alone with Kohlmeister, who had never taken his hands off the ship wheel the whole time. Well, except perhaps for that one time when he pulled the whistle cord. Meanwhile, Mr. Brennan was running to the captain's cabin. Remember, Brennan is the first mate. Running to the captain's cabin where he got out the dead skipper's revolver. Back to the bridge he skulked with that pistol, and from the shadows about 10 feet away he opened fire, emptying the 5-shot pistol at the bandit. It was probably a cheap 32 or 38 caliber break frame pocket revolver, which would explain why the curtain of fire he laid down proved fairly ineffective. Quote, he seemed to bear a charmed life, for not a bullet struck him, Brennan told the newspaper. By this time, the lone man was thoroughly scared. He ran back to the smokestack, but as he did so, he let it go another shot at me. That's the last time I saw him. Brennan was now the acting captain, so he ordered the engines shut off and the lights doused, basically putting the whole show on pause until morning. When the sun came up, Wise was found, huddled in his bunk in steerage, whimpering to himself. He went insane before he could be tried and was committed to an asylum. Nobody ever found a trace of West. Most accounts say he jumped overboard, but nobody actually saw him do so. For all we know, he could have hidden out someplace underneath and gotten away. But I doubt it. Remember, this guy had just smoked down their captain in cold blood. And from reading these sources, the captain of this ship was held in fairly high regard by his men. I think it's a pretty good chance that somebody came across him in the middle of the night and there was a little private justice meted out. We'll never know. That's it for today's episode. If you're listening for the first time and want more info about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get it all at our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com, which includes the complete catalog of about 199 columns going back to 2008. Plus, there's links to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes that you can have set up to come directly to your smartphone, and also links to Facebook and Twitter. The website's also where you'll find full citations. Sources for today's episode include works by Stan Allen, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Portland Morning Oregonian. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis? Drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at Finn at offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, at offbeatoregon. If you've tried to get a hold of me before, sometimes my email application buries stuff. Please do try again. Don't worry about bugging me. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. And that is it for today. In coming attractions, tomorrow we're going to be talking about the town of Prineville. Prineville, Oregon, the town that was bypassed by the railroad and refused to roll over and die. Instead, they built their own railroad. It's an interesting story. Look for that after about 6 a.m. tomorrow, and in the meantime, go ahead and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.